Okay, I don't see Rabbi Kelman, but it's 9 o'clock and we have a lot to do. So with Shalom Eisenstadt's permission, I will begin. I think I have about 20 minutes to finish up with Rav Gorin and then move into Rav Kafach, Rav Yosef Kafach. We ended last class talking about the beginnings of the Langer case, which was very important, as I mentioned, because it led to Rav Yosef, who felt that he can no longer serve, felt that he could not serve under Rav Gorin, because the chief rabbi is head of the Bat Dei Din. He resigns, and that leads to his position today. What was the situation, though? As I said, this is the most significant controversy among Rabbanim in Israel since the beginning of the state, probably in the whole second half of the 20th century. A series of Bat Dei Din had declared that these two children, now they're old, they're ready to get married, brother and sister, Langer children, were mamzerim and they were unable to marry. Now, both of them were soldiers in the army. They had come under Moshe Dayan's wing, I guess you could say. The word was out, and Dayan was pushing that if a way was not found for them to marry, civil marriage would be instituted in the state of Israel. Now, today, people might say that's a good idea, with the hundreds of thousands of Russians and all, but in those days, the religious Zionists all agreed you need to have religious marriage. The case was simple enough. Mrs. Langer had been married before World War II, and after the war, she remarried without receiving a get from her husband. Simple enough. Now, when trying to free Mamzerim, people of the taint of Mamzerim, Poskim use every single kula they can. They try to create sfeikot, doubts, try to create uncertainties. If you create a few uncertainties, already it's no longer a Torah prohibition, it's a rabbinic prohibition, you throw another uncertainty in, and you can permit the person to marry. I have no doubt that had Rav Gorin's reasons, his justifications, been presented by a Haredi Gadol, that they would have been no problem, they would have been accepted. As it is, his argument is found in this very rare book. I don't believe it'll ever be reprinted because it was published by the Chief Rabbinate of Israel. Here it is. Psak HaDin B'inyan Ha'ach V'Ha'achot. It is well over, it's 200 pages. In addition to halachic argumentation, it's also full of legal documents, testimony, all sorts of things, in which he sets forth the case, and I'll describe it in a minute. The problem was, and Rabbi Kelman mentioned this last class, the battle of the Langer children became tied up with the battle between Rav Gorin and the other Rabbanim, especially the Haredim, and the children became pawns. I said the joke last week. I actually said it mistakenly. The joke was the first chief rabbi is a Kohen, then comes a Levi, then a Hedyot Yisrael, and then a reformer. Not Bikoros. They regarded Rav Gorin as a reformer. And you can read the Haredi attacks against Rav Gorin, and they feel a lot of pleasure and pride in being able to refute what he says and to show that he's mistaken. And yet you never get a sense in all their arguments of the pain that by refuting him and showing that he doesn't know anything, which what they desperately wanted to do, this means that two people are never able to marry. So it's impossible to read the arguments against Rav Gorin and not feel a sense that they're forgetting about the children, and it's becoming the children are only pawns. It's a battle. And I said last class that Rav Gorin was willing to destroy his Olam Hazeh for the sake of freeing these children. Of course, from the Haredi perspective, it was cynical, because even before he became chief rabbi, he let it be known that he thinks that there's a way they could free these people. And if the cynical approach for the Haredi was that he wanted to become chief rabbi, and that's there was a quid pro quo with the government. The problem was that he wanted the chief rabbinate council as a whole, when he became chief rabbi, to reconsider this matter. Rav Avadi Yosef said absolutely not, that he has to recuse himself because he was on the previous Beit Din that found the Mamzerim, and he said that Rav Gorin should also recuse himself because he had already expressed an opinion. Rav Gorin refused to do that, and he established his own Beit Din with 9 Dayanim on this Beit Din. However, the identities of all of these Dayanim was kept secret. We now know that one of the Dayanim was Rav Avraham Shapiro. The reason we know that is because in my Lieberman Kuntras, my little Lieberman pamphlet, you see in one of Rav Gorin's letters, that he reveals that Rav Shapiro was one of them. Why was this secret? Rav Goren, in his pamphlet, in his booklet here, has to explain what gives him the right to have a base to that secret. The reason was the anti-Goren attacks were at their height. No Dayan would agree to, with his identity known, be part of such a Beistin. It would mean that he'd be cast as an outcast. Now, Rav Goren might not have cared about this, but these other Dayanim had children in Haredi yeshivas, they had children who needed to be married, and for them, it would destroy their whole life. But Rav Goren was able to take the heat, as they say, and these nine Dayanim and him came and with a ruling that they were to be freed. As soon as they were to be freed, and you can go back to Hapardes and the other journals, all hell broke loose, and Rav Goren was cast in the mold as a reformer. Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who never signed proclamations against other Rabbanim, they signed the proclamation against Rav Goren declaring that none of his psukim are valid. In other words, he lost his authority as a Rav. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was in Israel, so he saw what was going on. Rav Moshe Feinstein was in America, and he was relying on people like Rav Yecheskel Abramsky and others. So when Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach announced that he no longer has authority, you see that this is an incredible situation. The only... one more thing, that Rav Goren refuses to back down. He sends a letter to Lieberman, which I published, and says that in the end, he says, Gamzo Latov, Gamzu Latov. He's happy that this happens, because until then, he always was afraid to give halachic rulings looking over his shoulder. What would the Haredim say? Now, since the Haredim have thrown him out of the Torah world, that is their Torah world, he can decide halacha without what we would call negios, without any looking over his shoulder. He can look at the halacha, because it's not going to matter anyway. They don't regard him as a rabbi anymore. So he says, after the fact, he's able to say, Gamzu Latov. It's a good question I was asked. You know, Rav Avadia almost always comes up with heterim. In this case, he could not. I will say that once Rav Goren ruled that they were not mamzerim, Rav Avadia then signed on and registered them as agreed that they could be registered as able to marry, and he took a lot of heat for that as well. But he himself, what can I say? He himself was not able to find a heter for them. That just shows you the problem here. The main point. Let me just say also, there was one Rav from who was not the religious Zionist rabbi, who defended Rav Goren. That was Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin in America at this time was quite elderly, and he declared that Rav Goren is the Mara d'Asra, at least for the Ashkenazim, although his views cannot be Ladoros, permanent application, because many Ravonim disagree with him. He is the Rav, he's looked into it, and we must accept his decision. And this was even taped. And this was played in Israel because they recorded. People would not believe Rav Henkin really said it, but Rav Henkin publicly defended Rav Goren. Now, what was the main point that Rav Goren was able to use? He argued that there was no proof that Langer's first husband had ever converted to Judaism. He was a convert. He cited evidence that he went to church. They had a church wedding, by the way. Langer's first husband, the woman, Mrs. Langer's first husband, and he had a church wedding. He brought all sorts of proofs that he never conducted himself as Jewish, and that there never was a conversion. This was debated, by the way, from the other side. But I think you can agree that there are certain sfeikot that were raised. The Haredim argued, absolutely not. He was Jewish, and they said the fact that he then gave up Judaism and has no connection to Judaism, that is totally irrelevant. He still is a Jew. I think this is very interesting because the Haredim were arguing that you cannot void a conversion, you can never void a conversion, and they even cited Rav Kook. Rav Kook had a tshuva about a man who converted to marry a Jew, and then he reverted to a non-Jewish practice and even married a non-Jew. And Rav Kook said a conversion is a conversion, you cannot retract the conversion. I think it's ironic because today we're hearing all about how the Batei Din in Israel are not accepting conversions, even if it's done by Orthodox rabbis, are not accepting it. And I don't know what that means for a person who converts. Does that mean they could eat on Yom Kippur? But in the Gorin dispute, they were saying you cannot void a conversion. This was a valid conversion by an Orthodox Rav. And Rav Gorin wasn't, from his perspective, he wasn't even voiding a conversion. He was simply saying there's no evidence that a conversion had ever taken place to begin with. But it was an incredible dispute. For the rest of his life, Rav Gorin was an outcast in the Torah world, other than the religious Zionist world. Other than at Yeshiva University, he was not welcome in any yeshivas. The Agudas Rabbanim in America would not welcome him. The only place he could speak in America was at the, let's say, the Rabbinical Council of America convention. That was the only place he was given kavod. He still had power as chief rabbi, but the Torah world was close to him. There are no Sfarim that had his haskamot. If you look at great rabbis, they always write approbations. You don't find Sfarim that have his haskamot, except for some in the religious Zionist world. Other Gedolim did not correspond with him. He lived as an outcast. In the end, as I said, the Beit Din ruled the children could marry. Religious marriage and divorce was saved. And Rav Gorin had removed himself from the Torah world. I guess you could say his whole life was leading up to this, because he had a whole different vision, as we'll see, and wanted to create a different Torah society. But it must have been very painful. You ask, was it halachic or political or halachic? It's both. Politics were there before it began. What I mentioned before is, without the politics, I don't think they would have made a big deal about it. If Rav Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had used the same arguments, they would have given him slack. But since they had such opposition to him anyway, for political reasons, but also halachic reasons, quasi-halachic, everything he did was tied into politics and halacha, and he had a vision, as I said, of a dynamic halacha. Not since Rav Chaim Hirschenson has there been a posek like Rav Gorin, who believed in a real dynamic halacha, who believed there was no problem that halacha could not solve, could not deal with. And this troubled him, but when he was in the army, okay, it wasn't such an issue. I should also note, though, that it wasn't just a break between the Haredim. He also had a break between, and this developed over the next few years. This was 73, the decision came out 74. Over the next couple of years, he had a break also with much of the religious Zionist world. The National Religious Party, which had put him into office, they broke with him to a large extent, because Rav Gorin wanted to assume the role of the Aguda types. He wanted to issue rulings on religious matters that the National Religious Party would have to follow. And the NRP refused to go along with this. They said, we are not the Aguda. We don't have a Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. There were many in the Aguda, in the National Religious Party in Mizrahi, who didn't like the fact that the chief rabbinate was totally removed now from the more traditional Haredi elements. That was never the case with Rav Unterman, with Rav Herzog, or with Rav Kook. Many of them were annoyed with Rav Gorin for moving in and taking over Rav Unterman's position. And finally, there were some who thought that he was wrong. Rav Shaul Yisraeli, for example, the other great religious halachic authority of the religious Zionists, was also on the Beis Din. The Beis Din had three members, the final Beis Din, that ruled the children were Mamzerim: Rav Yoshev, Rav Avad Yosef, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli. No one could accuse Rav Shaul Yisraeli of not being a right-wing religious Zionist. In fact, in 1978, there was another election. They were able to get another election for chief rabbi, and Rav Shaul Yisraeli ran against Rav Gorin, but he lost. So by 1978, Rav Gorin was left with the religious loyalty of maybe half the religious Zionist population, and that is it. He tried to portray this as a dispute against him like it was against Rav Kook with the extremists, but that really is not true. Rav Yoshev and Rav Shaul Yisraeli, these are not opponents of Rav Kook. It could be in another 100 years all the fighting, all the controversy will have been forgotten. I hope so. And I hope everyone can open up his Sfarim and use them. If you look at his three volumes on the holidays, there is nothing that compares to them in terms of organization, in terms of ideas. I really think they're top of the line, and it's a shame they're not used in yeshiva circles, because it really is better than anything out there. And I hope in 100 years, people, you know how many machlokas there were in America? The rabbanim, every rav in America in the 20s was fighting, was killing another rabbi. Now we forget about it. We're not concerned. We read this far in Europe, the machlokas between Rabbanim, we're not concerned anymore. So hopefully that will be the case with Rav Gorin. He had another great dispute I can't get into now. It's called the Seidman dispute, where he converted a woman who was going to be with a Kohen. And his tshuva has been published, and he relies on Rav David C. Hoffman. We already saw Rav David C. Hoffman. That in emergency circumstances, you can allow a woman who converts to be with a Kohen if she lives as his Pilegesh. And we have his letter to Rav Abramsky. Rav Yechezkel Abramsky was his great critic, and he says it's a shas adchak. They're going to institute civil marriage. We need to rely on Rav David C. Hoffman. And that was the case where Rav Soloveitchik specifically rejects Rav Gorin and says that this is impossible. We cannot rely on such a position. Now, there's no such thing as removing smicha, I don't think. The Berlin Rabbinical Seminary said, anyone who graduated Berlin Rabbinical Seminary, the document said, that it came with what they called a hodah ne'amana, that the person was not permitted to take a pulpit with an organ, and if he does, he no longer regarded as having any religious any rabbinic authority. So I guess in theory, that's an example of where they did remove the smicha, but what does it mean? Because every time they're hired, and there were graduates by synagogues with organs, synagogue still regard him as rabbi. Who could take away Rav Gorin's smicha? Rav Zalman Meltzer, who I think gave it to him, he wasn't alive anymore. You can't. The only person who could remove the smicha would be the person who gives the smicha. And, I mean, we've had scandals in the last 5 or 6 years, sexual abuse scandals, all sorts of scandals. I never heard of anyone speaking about Yeshiva University removing the smicha from, let's say, Baruch Lanner or other smichas from other yeshivas. But the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary did say that the person loses his title of rabbi. But it's meaningless, because if you're going to go to a conservative reform synagogue, they will accept the title. The fact, they'll say that this is all political. But they did say he doesn't have authority as a psak. So Rabbi Kellen points out Rabbi W.C. Hoffman. That's the one I'm talking about, where he mentions in that tshuva, he mentions the Hodah Ne'amana, the public declaration of the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. And we have copies of it. Every Berlin Rabbinical Seminary graduate was given such a document. I guess the equivalent today would be maybe if you took a shul without a machitza. I don't know. What about wife covering hair? About Rav Gorin? Okay, that's interesting, Rav Riskin. I don't know about his position on that. Rav Gorin himself was very mocked on many areas. For example, the Erev. He didn't carry in the Erev in Jerusalem. And when you ask about wife covering hair, I assume his wife did cover hair. I mean, I don't know what his shita is. In those days, many of the Litvish Rabbanim, their wives didn't. But as far as I know, she did. That's the daughter of the Nazir. When his term ended in the 1980s, the early 1980s, there was widespread relief that he was off the stage. In 1983, Rav Avram Shapiro was elected, and things calmed down. I mean, there was machlokas between him and Rav Avadia, and machlokas all over the place. But we have to say that he lost his battle to remake Eretz Yisrael Judaism. And even among many of the religious Zionists, they had tired of what they regarded as his grandstanding. The machlokas, they didn't do machlokas. No, the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary would not remove smicha from a graduate whose wife uncovered her hair. That's not true. They would only remove smicha from one who took a pulpit in a non-Orthodox seminary. In a non-Orthodox synagogue. And when I say non-Orthodox synagogue, a synagogue with an organ. That's a non-halachic synagogue. They were mockpit in Berlin on covering hair, but they did not remove smicha. Not all of their graduates did. In fact, there's a letter from Rabbi Weinberg to one of the leading graduates, which I haven't published, in which he discusses this a bit. And this graduate who's a dayan in Leeds, England, Rabbi Apfel, his wife never covered her hair, and he was one of the leading rabbanim in England, so there was never such a thing. Rav Gorin, beginning in 1983, lived a private life then, for the rest of his life. Towards the end of his life, he came out of retirement, as it were, during when Israeli soldiers, when the talk was about Israeli soldiers having to uproot settlements. And Rav Gorin issued a psak. He was the first one to issue the psak that it's forbidden for soldiers to help in removing, destroying Jewish settlements. This obviously became a big deal in Gush Katif. And other rabbis later joined in his decision, but Rav Gorin was the first one, but he really had no kahila. When he retired, he no longer had the rabbinate. He no longer had the army. He didn't have a following. He built this yeshiva. Next time you're at the Kotel, you'll see the Yeshiva Hedra Rabbah. It's right up top there. He built the yeshiva, and he had some students, but he never really had a following. What they asked is if a shul had mixed seating, was it acceptable? It's hard to say because there were no mixed seating synagogues in Germany. That's an American phenomenon. So it never really occurred to the Rabbanim in Germany to put mixed seating down. The thing is, the organ was a symbol of reform. Even though halachically you could make certain cases for it, maybe during the weekday or with a non-Jew playing it, it became such a symbol for reform that the symbolism was very important. They, reform did not have mixed seating in Germany, so they never made that an issue. And so the answer is no. You did not lose your smicha for taking a mixed seating congregation. You didn't lose your smicha in America either, from YU, from Chaim Berlin. Plenty of these rabbanim took mixed seating congregations. Yes, David Eisen mentions, no, it's not organs for wedding. Organs for wedding is not a problem. It's organs in the synagogue for services. Meshiv Mochama, we mentioned Meshiv Mochama last class, and I'll get back to it in a few minutes. I will tell you, he published a number of volumes. He's also well known. He was the first one to give the tshuva permitting women's prayer groups. In fact, he also said, now women's prayer groups today are passé, because now the women are davening with men in these so-called Orthodox egalitarian mechitza minyanim, but Rav Gorin paskin that women could daven in their own minyanim, Devarim Shebikdusha, Barachu, Kriyas HaTorah, the rest of it, with the brachas. That's what he held. The controversy that is created, he then retracted, or he said, I never intended it, la-maisa, it was only la-halacha, but he was the first posek, and this decision was given, by the way, when he was chief rabbi, but only became widely known after he left, the chief rabbinate. Okay, so it's now joined. The yeshiva really couldn't survive without him. He didn't really leave any great followers or great talmidim. Let me tell you two more things about Rav Gorin, just to get a sense of the man. In one of the volumes that came out after his death, it's called Torah HaRefuah, dealing with all sorts of medical issues, and here you see how different he is than other poskim. He had to deal with the status of a deaf mute, a cheresh. What's the status today? Is he considered a regular Shomer Torah Mitzvah? We can give him aliyah, because in the days of Chazal, they regarded, it was a different situation. They didn't have the training like we have. And he tells us that from the Bavli, it's very difficult to count a cheresh as any other Jew. So he says, I'm going to use the Yerushalmi. He tells us that he's not looking at this in a detached way. It's obvious he wants to arrive at a decision. He tells us that the Yerushalmi helps us to expand the halachic status of a cheresh, and he says, quote, this is our combined moral, religious, and humanitarian obligation. What does this mean? Why is there a moral obligation? There's halacha. You look at this post-poskim. Look at Shas. Rav Gorin says we have a humanitarian obligation. Where is there a religious obligation to help out a cheresh? This would be news to all the poskim who disagree with him. And what is this business of a chova enoshit, a humanitarian obligation? Since when does that have anything to do with halacha and come into halachic deliberations? I think most poskim wouldn't even recognize that as a valid category. And yet Rav Gorin uses these considerations to arrive at halachic conclusion. He tells us that these factors, the chova enoshit, the humanitarian considerations, that's what's forcing him to look at the Yerushalmi. If he didn't have a Yerushalmi, he says he wouldn't have been able to come to a conclusion to count the cheresh like any other Jew. But since we have the Yerushalmi, he's willing to go against the Bavli, go to the Yerushalmi. I mean, these categories, though, are not part of the traditional Torah, way of looking at things. Our moral, religious, and humanitarian obligation. When a posek looks at a case of an aguna, he bends over backwards. He tries to find a way to free the woman. But that's nothing new. Chazal tells us to do this. Rav Gorin is using this approach of looking at the humanitarian situation, looking at the feelings of the person, and using what Chazal said to do with Mamzerim and Aguna, and applying it to modern circumstances as well. I mean, it's quite original. It's very sad we no longer have figures like Rav Gorin, even if they cause controversy. Who other than Rav Gorin would take a look at the Masada Tefillin? They discovered Tefillin on Masada. Rav Gorin wrote a halachic essay. Are these Tefillin sectarian or halachic? Who would discuss the case of kidnapped soldiers? Can they commit suicide so they don't be won't be tortured and give up information? Who else would discuss these sorts of things? It was Rav Gorin, as I said, who ruled that non-Jewish soldiers are buried together with Jewish soldiers. He was the first to permit organ transplants. He was the first to really get into army halacha. He's not the only one. There were others. For example, the Tzitz Eliezer. Here's a book, volume 2 of this book, Hilchot HaMedina, the Tzitz Eliezer. This was actually, it's an interesting book. It was published in the early years of the state, and then Rav Gorin never reprinted, and his children became very Haredi. They didn't want to reprint it. After he died, a pirated edition was printed. This was last year. And then they got the Eda Haredi to put a ban on this, you know, to stop all Sfarim dealers from getting it, but I was able to get a copy. And truthfully, I don't know about, certainly from the standpoint of civil law, it's illegal what they did. And maybe I shouldn't have bought it. But from the standpoint of Torah law, copyright, I think, is very different. Yes. If I publish a book, I can say no one else can reprint it. And incidentally, discountsfarim.com illegally put up Kisvei Rechi Yaakov Weinberg, which incidentally was just reprinted last week. If anyone wants, you can contact me. I called him up and said, are you from Jews? He said, yes. He says, how can you put up my book without my permission? Or my children. However, I don't know if Torah gives anyone the authority, even children, to say that once a Mechaber publishes a Sefer, and it's been out there, to say for political reasons, we're not going to reprint his Torah. After all, no one owns, and the Tziv has a famous tshuva on this. Once you write your Torah and put it out in the world, no one owns your Torah. Even your children, who maybe now are Satmar Chassidim, they don't own your Torah. The Torah belongs to Klal Yisrael. And I don't think, according to Torah law, anyone has the right. If they're not going to reprint, if they're going to reprint it, I have no right to reprint it, because they're going to get the royalties, etc. But if they're not going to reprint it, I don't think they have the right to say that I cannot reprint it, because the Torah is out there and it belongs to Klal Yisrael. And because the children now have a different philosophy than their father, I don't think that gives them the right to say that you can't reprint Rav Waldenberg's works. In volume 2, the Hilchot Medina are all about, it's originally 3 volumes, not one big one. Maybe we'll have a unit on Rav Waldenberg. In volume 2, he discusses army halacha, but more about, you know, Milchemes Mitzvah, Milchemes Rishus, who has to be drafted. Not the nitty gritty like Rav Gorin. I mean, the issues we spoke about even last week, to allow the PLO to have a way out. I mean, this is incredible. Okay, let me see a few more questions here. Well, you mentioned Rav Zevin. Rav Zevin discusses all sorts of interesting things, and there's no one like Rav Zevin. He created a whole new approach to halacha, halachic writing, and he's the one responsible for the Encyclopedia Talmudis. Yes, he discussed Shylock and halacha. He discussed war also in his book, Or Halacha. So he's another very important figure. My family has some yichus towards him. Anyone who read the Sfarim blog would have seen it, that he stayed in my grandfather's house for 6 months. In the city of Novozibkov. This is a story for another time. Now Discount Sfarim is only holding volume 1, which was out of print, but now publishyoursafer.com, you can get all the, you can get both of them. They just reprinted, but it amazed me. This is out of Lakewood, I think, or I don't know where it's from. No, I think it's Lawrence. They just decided they could take a book published in 2004 and put it on their website and start selling it. I still have about 100 copies left of it. Jonathan Hirsch asked Rav Gorin or Rav Chaim Hirschenson. Rav Chaim Hirschenson was more radical than Rav Gorin, but they both had an approach that halacha can basically solve every problem. Not every problem, but almost every problem. You just need to have the proper attitude. And both of them were of the opinion that it's a gullus mentality that doesn't allow us to solve a lot of these problems. You say, why would there be a copyright problem with Hilchos Medina after more than 50 years? I don't know what the law is. The law in America, incidentally, is 75 years, not 50 years. And the book was published in 1952, so it's more than 50 years. They were arguing based in that they're the Yorshim and they have the authority, and they were never going to reprint it because the grandchildren now are Eda Haredit. Rav Waldenberg was a big Tzioni, and his grandchildren became anti-Zionist. I don't know legally what the rule is in Israel on copyright, and certainly you can always renew the copyright. But in the Torah world, people usually don't pay attention to that. I heard from Professor Kleinman also about this. I asked him once about the Sansino. If you know the Sansino Talmud, there's also the traditional press, which is that the red, the darker red, the maroon volumes almost. Those were put out illegally, and they broke copyright. The Sri D.H. has a tshuva about this, saying it's usur to buy the traditional press. They were put under cherem. But Professor Lyman made a good point. He says that before traditional press did this, the Sansino Talmuds, they hadn't reprinted them. They were very expensive. They were only in the, they weren't, you know, English, Hebrew side to side. And he thought, you know, if you're not going to reprint them, and the Torah world needs these translations, this is pre-art scroll, and what happened was, as soon as traditional press did this, then Sansino reprinted them, and that was the standard for many years. Even the Rav used to, he'd come into Shir sometimes, and, you know, he had these words. He used to look it up in Sansino. You know, the words, instead of looking at Jastra, he looked at Sansino. And, in fact, if you get a copy of his, I was told, his Sansino, he has only the English one. You see his notes on the side, pointing out places where he thinks Sansino makes a mistake. You know, after he prepared the sugya, he used to look and see, you know, how did Sansino read it? They were big Talmidei Chachamim who did Sansino, but they were what we call today modern Orthodox types, not Haredim. And there's a lot in the footnotes there, which today would be regarded by Art Scroll as Kafira. No question of it, no doubt about it. They talk about historical events, it's not really have happened the way the Talmud describes it, etc. When David points out about the Chafetz Chaim writing about Army Halacha, what the Chafetz Chaim was writing about was about Jews drafted into the Russian army and how they remained from certain problems, you know, kashrus and all. Rav Gorin was writing about a Jewish army where you have kosher food. Those were not the issues. The issues were who is drafted halachically. What's the status of the Mechamis Mitzvah? What do we do with prisoners? Can we kill innocents together with, you know, can we bomb a city and kill innocents? Those are the issues that were being discussed. So it's very different issues. And Rav Gorin's whole point was that a Jewish army has a completely different approach. We cannot look at the Rambam, Hilchos Malachim, alone. We need to re-examine it. So here we hear 70 years after the death of the author, and I assume, David, that you can renew it if you want. At least in America, you can renew copyright. I believe that Rav Gorin, let me just say a few more things. Question before we go on. Oh, you don't think so? Okay, that's interesting. In America, I don't know about books. Certainly you can renew, because Disney had this problem. You can renew. Disney was able to renew their copyright over Mickey Mouse and the rest of them. I don't know what the situation is with books. You can always publish a new edition, but I don't know. I don't know that. Well, I know for a fact, because I know someone who works in Art Scroll, that they have Rav Gorin's Perish, and they use it. But the response is that Rav Gorin used Louis Ginsberg without quoting him by name either, so I don't know. In the Torah world, though, you're never going to see Rav Gorin or Lieberman or the rest of them quoted in those circles. There's a tshuva, incidentally, of Menashe Klein. If you look at Sfarim, sometimes Sfarim are reprinted. Just photo offsets, and they'll say, Kol es chuyot shemurot, that, you know, copyright. And he says, and he's absolutely right, that if I reprint a sefer from the 1850s, I can't say it's copyrighted. You know, I haven't done anything. Anyone could reprint it himself. As pointed out in the book on Rav Gorin that I mentioned, he quotes Yosef Klausner, who's a mechanech, a Torah scholar in Israel, who says as follows, Rav Gorin represented the total hashkafa of the Haredi, a total hashkafa of what the Haredi camp could not accept. He wasn't just different, he was the opposite of them. I mean, just think of what I spoke about last week, about leaving the opening for the PLO to escape. Here was a halachic shaila that in 2,000 years had never been considered, lamaisa. I mean, these are the things that Rav Gorin had to deal with. Yes, Art Scroll, open up the Art Scroll, and they say that we do not allow for, even for personal use, the rights of the copy holder will be strictly enforced. You can ignore that completely. Art Scroll cannot make the law. The law in the United States is personal use is permissible. To copy one page, two pages for personal use, the United States government says that's permissible. So Art Scroll, which is operating in the American commercial law, American trademark law, they can't copyright something and then say that they want to be more strict than the U.S. government. So you can certainly, without any pangs of conscience, ignore if you want to make a page or two for personal use. Whether halachically, that's another story, and I've never heard anyone say that the halacha has any different standard than personal use. And I would think this is the perfect example where Dina de Mahusa determines what you can copy. I would say that Rav Goren was the last advocate of a dynamic halacha, a halacha that sees the state of Israel as the beginning of a new era. Rav Goren points out, as I said, that Hilchos Malachim of the Rambam will not work today. We need a new approach. Ultimately, he failed. Even the religious Zionist rabbis were not willing to go along with him. The path of Rav Goren would have meant a complete break with Haredi Judaism, which I think over time we're seeing that in Israel. The religious Zionists have completely broke, but his break was not an organic, a slow break. Rav Goren's break would have been immediate, and his Judaism is completely different. It's halacha, but it's nothing like the conservative halacha of the Haredim. At the end of the day, and not just the Haredim, like Rav Soloveitchik, like most poskim. At the end of the day, the religious Zionists did not want there to be a schism with the Haredi world. Rav Goren didn't either, but he must have realized that his approach would lead to that. And as I said, and we'll end with this, he really believed, as with Rav Chaim Hirschenson, that you don't throw up your hands. Any halachic problem has to have a solution. It might not be the best solution, but there's going to be a solution. And you need to work at it. And you can't be afraid. You need to look at the sources. And he says that we have a mandate now. We don't need to be bound by hundreds of years of halakha decisions in the Golos. Because a decision by the Noda Yehuda in Prague 200 years ago, that could be under different circumstances. We're in a different era now. We're creating a state. Things have to be different. The Haredim regarded living in the land of Israel as just another Golos. So they had a very different perspective on this. Ultimately, though, Rav Goren failed, but he still was a very inspiring figure, and he failed on the national scene. But I hope that over time, people will look at his writings and use him. Lamaisa, I mean, his Chuvos are now beginning to be published. They published the first volume of Chuvos last year, and there is such interesting stuff in there, and it's a shame. Will he be reinvented as a hero? It is possible. The problem is the liberal Orthodox are going to have a problem because his Zionism is very right-wing. I mean, he does not believe in giving back any land, and he really has a Das Torah conception in that the Rabbanim have to have veto over the political leaders. The NRP refused to accept this. The liberal Orthodox can't get into that. They don't want to give a veto power to any rabbi. So he has certain perspectives which are troubling. So I don't know if he's going to be reinvented, but maybe. There are many Haredim teaching in Mizrahi schools. I don't know. We have to get people from Israel to comment on. I know from my time in Israel, for the most part, the religious Zionist world is very split from the Haredi world. You don't have Haredim coming in teaching in religious Zionist schools. And as yeshivas, I mean, there's enough of a Torah movement now where they have their own, it's not like America. I don't know, Ariz, if you're saying it's Mizrahi in America, of course. All of our day schools are full of Haredi teachers. But in Israel, it's a different situation, and they have such a break. They don't really care what the Haredi Rabbanim say. It's a completely different world. In Israel, okay, well, that's interesting. My experience in the yeshivas there is not at all in the Hezri yeshivas. I can't speak for the other schools. I don't know. We have someone from Beit Shemesh, if he can confirm that it's been his experience as well. Rav Shach taught in Mizrahi school, but that was already 40 years ago. It's news to me. Did Rav Goren communicate with Rav Soloveitchik? He communicated when he came to Yeshiva University, and he gave shiur. And the Rav let him give shiur even towards the end in his class. But the Rav spoke out against him, and the Rav might not have been a nice thing to do. Rav Goren would leave, and the next day the Rav would speak out against everything he said in his shiur. So they did not have such a good relationship. So we have David from Beit Shemesh concurring with me. So we need one more person. to make it a base 10. But look, I'm not saying there are no Haredim there, but if you look in the Bnei Akiva schools, I can't speak for the elementary schools, but certainly look at the high schools and look at the Hezra yeshivas and the religious science yeshivas, you will not find a Haredi there. They're all the graduates of Hezra, the graduates of Merkaz. In my years in yeshiva, there was no Haredim. It was, unless you count Rav David Miller as a Haredi, I mean, you had in BMT, you might have had, and that was not an Israeli yeshiva, though, but it's not something, they just don't have it. They don't need it anymore.